Thank you all for being here. On the subject of thanks, two notes of gratitude. The first note of gratitude is to Phil Bevis and his beautiful bookstore. At a time in which we seem to be losing ground on the precious things, Phil's fighting the right battle. And so I'm glad he's on our side. We're happy to be on his side. Also, a note of gratitude to poets and writers who have helped sponsor tonight's event. But also, I have to say thank you all for being here. Friday night in Pioneer Square for poetry. You know, I wouldn't take bets on this being full, but I couldn't be happier. It's my job to introduce the book to you, just give you a little sense of the lay of the land of it. There's three editors and a designer. So I'm one of the editors, Paul Nelson right there, you'll hear from him at the end of the night. It's another one. The third is Adelia McWilliam. She is on the other side of the imperial line that splits Cascadia into two, into the United States and Canadian sides. This being a book inspired in some ways by Zen, more on that in a moment, we decided to take the Zen perspective on borders. The Zen teaching always says, think of yourself as a cloud. The cloud doesn't go, oh my God, it's Mexico, bring out the guns. No, the cloud just goes wherever. It goes wherever these things move, and so it's a book written as if that border did not exist. But it is also a book that's written to acknowledge all the pain that borders have caused historically in all their variations. So the book is also, it's got a deep sense of trying to begin the work of spiritual reparations. The title itself, Teresa Whitehill, the fourth person on there, she's the one who designed the book, and you can see, wow, she's really good at it. It's a very beautiful looking book. The title itself, Cascadian Zen. Cascadia itself, you'll hear more about it because we have somebody here who's married to a student of the person who came up with the name. But Cascadia itself, it's an experiment in trying to rethink how we map our sense of space. So the old way of mapping our sense of space was to look down on the land from on high, as if you owned it, to take inventory, draw lines of influence, mark out where the resources are, tuck people away in desirable and undesirable places depending on who they are, this sort of project. The Cascadia map is going the other direction. It's not from the Imperium from on high, it comes from below. It starts with the land, and it tries to think deeply about what the land has made possible. And of course, as we say in Zen, originally not one thing. It's a wondrous place, and it's made many things possible. And so there's no like Cascadian theme. If you're really a Cascadian, here's what you think about, here's how you speak. That's a very un-Cascadian idea. So it's really the other way around, to try to create space and to create conditions for the audibility of the amazing different kinds of voices here, the beautiful, how shall we say, poetic biodiversity of all the persons here, human and non-human. Those who, poets, philosophers, interviewers, but also artists. And of course we can't get everyone, but we got as many as we could. And there's volume 2 coming out later this year. Now the word Zen, that's an even trickier term, because this book is not for, if you do Zen, by the way, you'll love this book, you really will. You'll recognize a lot of things. But it's not, wow, if you like Zen, you'll like this book. If you don't, what's wrong with you? Don't you understand Cascadia? It's not that at all. Zen is really kind of a throwaway word. It includes things that you might more properly recognize as Zen. But Zen really just is a shorthand for any place-aware practice. And so it names things as diverse and as variegated as the voices in this book. There's lots of different ways to channel what it is to be here, but we just call all that Zen because what we're really trying to say is not you should do Zen, but we're trying to think from the ground up. That's a lot of work. It requires also asking ourselves hard questions. That's something we also do traditionally in Zen also, to really see what's blocking you from hearing everybody. And so I'll just read to you two little paragraphs that speak to the Zen part of the text, and then I'll turn things over to Anne, who's going to be our first speaker. In drawing these works together, We are not implying that all the authors have a commitment to Zen practice, or Buddhist practice more broadly, or even to what remains vital in many of the world's other practices. Although many of the authors have, for want of a better phrase, serious spiritual practices, Buddhist and non-Buddhist, what unites these otherwise varied voices is a practice commitment to awakening and cultivating the mind of this place, to the Cascadian heart-mind out of which language presences and gives rise to what the Chinese poets call the dragons of this place. Some of these dragons are gentle, others whimsical, while still others speak of grievous historical, cultural, and ecological wounds. The awakening and expression of the Cascadian heart-mind world is not merely celebratory and grateful, but also careful, mindful, worried, vigilant. So I think it produces some beautiful things, but beauty that does not express reality, that tries to imagine we'll escape to beauty, that's not Cascadia. We're trying to be here for the first time with everyone who's here. So I hope you'll take a look at the book. And our next really, really big advertisement for the book is one of its contributors, Ann Spires, who's a wonderful poet, and she'll introduce herself.
Thank you so much for that introduction, but you could go on and introduce me with those glowing words. Thank you. Being in this book is like being with everybody that you have met in poetry, north in the Northwest, down to Northern California, or that you've read with, that you've read, that you wanted to know. And so I thank you. I have great gratitude. And reading through it is like going, it's not like a class reunion. It's like going to the prom you never went to. You know, you just want to sit on the page with each person. So to introduce myself, I think that I want you to know that the COVID years, those 3 years, were great for me. At the beginning, I sent out 3 manuscripts. Within 2 weeks, all 3 were picked up. I mean, that was good. So one was Rain Violent from Empty Bowl, which I'm also proud to be aligned with. And Rain Violent is about climate change, and it's about moving through the landscape and the emotion, not the emotions, but the landscape and the circumstances we see from day to day. And in retrospect or in foresight, you see the effect of climate change very personally. The other one was Backcut, Husband and Wife, 1941, post-World War II, digging razor clams on the Oregon coast, I mean the Washington coast. And it's monologues, husband, wife, husband, wife, husband, wife. And the last one is called Harpoon from Ravenna. And it's the impetus for that was to go down to Baja where I could see the gray whales because my grandfather shot whales off of Westport, Washington. So that's me. I'm going to read from 3 poets in this book. The first one is Judith Roach. Judith Roach in her poem says, "I'm still trying to learn how to walk edges and bounce off walls, weaving my way through crowds, running interference." Well, all of us who interacted with Judith Roach thought she knew how to do all that already. She was capable, she was a fine poet, and she was open to listening to us, to helping us. And she started, or was one of she became the main manager for the literature program at Bumbershoot. So this is by Judith Roach. "The 3 bones in the inner ear run on trust alone. While computers raise the Titanic, the earth is splitting its skin like a baked apple. I'm still trying to learn how to walk edges and bounce off walls while weaving my way through crowds. I listen for what the deepest blood says to me, while running interference with the soft tissues. The bones know, but they don't tell. Austere in their simple cleanliness, they know they will outlast the rest by 6,000 years and can't be bribed. I passionately wait for the next message, and I believe it perfectly. In my poem, which will be the last one I read, Tim McNulty's also mentioned in it, but he is still with us, and he is certainly capable of reading his own poems, so I'm going to skip to Robert Sund. To me, Robert Sund is the Northwest poet who did it. To me, he is the first, the foremost, the first, and the last Northwest poet. And interestingly, his first book that gained notice was called Bunchgrass, and it seems to me like he grew up in Grays Harbor, went to the University of Washington, where a teacher told him, you know, drop out of medical school, you're a poet, and he went to the Eastern Washington, where it's dry, the smells are different, the people are different, the culture's different, the climate's different, anyway, I recommend him. And so I'm going to read first one. This is called Herons and Swallows. Long spells of heron watching, now that the swallows have gone. In April, when the swallows return, the old heron will have less to do. April 24, 1977, 4 a.m. In the excited mind, words fly. The night is still, the water still, and suddenly in the mind, as on the night river a beaver breaks the silence, the first ripple of a poem swims almost invisible by the riverbank. Blades of grass standing in the water feel the waves rise and pass through them. So my poem is called Poets Traveling Water. I went to the Skagit River and the North Cascade Institute, probably in conjunction with the Skagit River Poetry Festival, offered a canoe ride for poets down the Skagit. So I joined Judith Roach in the boat and gave her a ride home afterwards. And I had done this once before, where you go down the Skagit River, and at a certain point after you get past Fishtown, where the poets dropped out in the 70s and 80s and stayed in fish shacks, in order to get off the Skagit, you don't go out to the salt water. You take a right, and you go over this berm. And when you make it over the berm, you're going from fresh water, from the Skagit River, to Saltwater by LeConnor. And if you ever have gone through a portal, it's like going through a portal. It's like the wardrobe in Narnia. It's like the phantom toll booth. And wonderfully, it's like Alice dropping in the hole. It's great. Okay. And the house we are visiting is Robert Sund's shack that he took over, built up on the Skagit on a side creek, called by some Shit Creek and others Disappearing Creek. Because when the tide went out, I assumed it disappeared. Poets Traveling Water, in memory of Judith Roach. One. The leaden clouds lower, even red, mutes in the threatening rain. In three canoes, 12 poets to each, we heft the paddles, balance the weight of self among others. The girl tells us to hold our oars thus, to stab the water, pull, lift, and arc the oar back to the stab. We ask, what do we do if there's a crisis? There'll be no crisis, she says. We freeze. We know that any water rises fast in sorrow or joy, lust or too much dancing. She says, look to me, all point, not to the threat, but to where I want you to swim. We consider the roiling current, the banks murky with silt and thick with prickly nuka rose. Two. We detour up Disappearing Creek to the pilings holding Robert's shack, hand-built with pickings from the river's flush. Chilled, we crowd in for tea, and Tim reading from Robert's poem, The Little Bird That Is Going to Heal Me. Then we are ready, warmed, poets paddling downstream. We brace hard, turn our canoes to where a space of land lowers, a bar between the Skagit's fresh water and the Pacific's brine. We skim toward escape from the narrow river. We join the shout, paddle, paddle hard, and we do the rush of it. Judith now again with us, water shallowing under our keels, lifting over the break where the river pulses and waves break. We cross from new water to old water, from fresh to salt, from one-way flow to the cycling energy of the ocean. We proceed, each canoe, steady as she goes, landing onto the full flood tide. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. Can you hear me? Am I in the mic? Okay. So, as I like to say, I am widely unknown and unpublished. I'm a haiku poet, and in many quarters, we are not considered real poets. And I am very, very grateful to be included in Cascadian Zen because it is such a fabulous book, but also because it is very rare for haiku poets to be included in regular poetry books. So I'm going to read some from Cascadian Zen first. Haiku are very short, so I'm going to probably read them twice so you get a chance to chew on it just for a moment. So here we go. Buddha statue on the altar. The young monk picks his nose. Buddha statue on the altar. The young monk picks his nose. 4th of July, the scent of barbecuing forests. 4th of July, the scent of barbecuing forests. Winter retreat, peeing outside the cabin. Another full moon. Winter retreat, peeing outside the cabin. Another full moon. Kubota Memorial, the heart stone, still beating. Kubota Memorial, the heart stone, still beating. Snail on my doorstep, you arriving, me departing. Snail on my doorstep, you arriving, me departing. And here's a few things that are called monoku. A lot of us are used to haiku being three lines, but there are now one-line haiku, and these are a few newer ones. Gray day. Toddler in yellow becomes the sun. Gray day. Toddler in yellow becomes the sun. Sir, making my way through the checkout line. Making my way through the checkout line. Night sky before words, the name for everything. Night sky before words, the name for everything. And I want to close with what's called a haibun, which is prose with some haiku interspersed, and this one is called Yuletide. It's winter solstice and the lowest tide of the year. I feel crummy after not sleeping well in weeks, but my sweetie insists we go on a nighttime beach walk. We make our way down to Puget Sound. A park shelter with cookies, hot cocoa, and a roaring fireplace greets us. Volunteer naturalists lead clusters of people, pointing out the various critters that inhabit the beach. There are oodles of folks of all ilk, many with children. It is stunning, an ocean of deep darkness pierced by tiny flashlight beams. Sea anemone, crabs, huge starfish, and octopus as we gently unearth their tide pool homes. It's remarkable how quiet and respectful we human beings are being. This is one of the haiku. Deep winter, even in sadness, morning star. I look at my beloved gently guiding me in this immense darkness. She holds my hand. This is how it is with us. Some days I am the one navigating. Then there are those bright, endless summer days when no guiding is necessary. Beauty is obvious, soaking into every pore. But on this longest night, it is her keeping me from falling on these slippery rocks, helping me glimpse the mysterious life usually hidden from us. I know I could not do this walk without her. I see all of us so fragile on this dark shore. And here comes the haiku. Against the big dark, hawthorn berries. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Alicia Hokanson, native Seattleite, steeped in Cascadia. Used to spend summers on Bainbridge as a kid, and now spend a lot of time up in the San Juan Islands. So the islands and the forests of Cascadia kind of raised me. I'm just really, really happy to be in this beautiful anthology. And I was so excited that Paul accepted 5 of my poems. Unbelievable. This first poem was written during the pandemic. And of course, one of the benefits of the pandemic was all that time at home, reading, sitting around. And it gave me a chance to rediscover some poets that I had just barely glanced through previously. I found a book on my shelf that a friend had given me by a poet translated by Red Pine. It's called The Mountain Poems of Stonehouse, or Shi Wu, who was a Buddhist recluse poet of the 13th century. And Shi Wu really spoke to me during those weeks of being secluded from society, as we all were. So this first poem is called January Quatrains. He wrote, many of the Chinese poets wrote in quatrains as a form. So this follows kind of one of his forms. January Quatrains, after Shi Wu. 800 years from you, on Red Cloud Peak, I hear your voice rise from rice paper pages. Everything's due on the grass, nothing's meant to last. On its way out of the dark, the morning rain light comes up through white clouds. I spent years longing for the retired life, now it seems too tame. Into the stone Buddha's lap, the dried brown scales fall. The juniper is thick and green above, raindrops glistering the branch ends. For 2 days, the wolf moon's hidden by thick cloud, leaving me only the whole white sky and a leaning pine dropping long needles into the grass. Bardo. Through frayed cuffs of gray cloud, wafts of spun smoke through shreds of rain over fields and farms are small plane hums over the lightly ruffled waves of island waters. All the grays above and all the greens below, torn heaven, stitched earth, and we, rent creatures, suspended in between. Earth Day. The hatchet makes a kindling song of shingles split for the morning fire, our tiny spurt of flame on the cosmic clock. Three hawks circle the blue envelope over the clearing where the cat chases a dark butterfly over just mowed grass. In the silence after machines, in April sun, the alders will unfurl their chartreuse fringe, and ferns send up curled fiddleheads. Far off in deep woods, a woodpecker hammers the stillness. This last poem was written after encountering an installation by James Turrell in Minneapolis at the Walker Art Center. You may have seen his installation here in Seattle at the Henry Gallery. It's called Sky Space, Light Rain. And I think that's this one in Minneapolis is somewhat similar, and it's called Sky Pesher. You cross the bright grassy hillside and enter it, a tunnel into the cement shelter, its bench around which everything seems to move, carved and tilted up toward the square of plexiglass, blue stage for the performance of an October sky. Witness to azure transparencies in a space for apprehending the light. You read time's meter, its blue gradient framed above. Mistress of wordless thought at the aperture of emptiness. I'm just going to read a couple poems from my recent book, Perishable World, which was a pandemic book. It's like, Anne, we all had all this time. Every poet I know had a book that came out of the pandemic. And this is mine. Because the news is so full of politics and discord, I thought I'd read a poem that I actually wrote in 2016, but I think it's just as apropos today, unfortunately, as it was then. But it's kind of supposed to be an antidote to all of that mayhem. And it's called Beauty Resists. So unexpected to come upon it as we followed the swerving wax wings, their commotion in the air, our umbrellas curtained. The gold ginkgo, double trunk rising from its yellow leavings, paving the sidewalk with real luster, cement softer under the mash of ochre leaves along the gutters, shine of rain over everything. In the park, vine maples hold on to some crimson tatters above the banks where the last salmon fight their way home. In the stream bed, the neighbors made good again. In these broken days, half the nation whipsawed in grief at what we will become. The sum of autumn's rubric is light and color in the trees, flash of silver fins in the creek, and late bees in the penstemon, still gathering pollen for the hive. I think we're all caught up in this situation of being housed and fed and, you know, living in a beautiful place, and yet we have to read about everything else that's going on in the world that's so distressing. And my friend Brenda Hillman had a wonderful quote in a little essay she wrote that kind of, I don't know, gives me some kind of solace. She said, "In forms of life other than the human, there is a vitality that isn't trapped in the sorrow." And that's the epigraph to this poem, Side by Side. All around the clearing, summer's gold fuse firing the alders, the click and sway of juncos gliding to grass light under apple trees. First heat from the wood stove kindled to flame, coffee in the blue cup, while the radio reports police have shot another child armed only with his blackness, and refugees spilling from flimsy boats mass at ragged borders. Hummingbirds buzz the closed blooms of honeysuckle twining the port trail. On the trail to the beach, kingfisher poised on his low branch chatters before the dive. Walking barefoot along the low tide selvage, where creamy foam wreathes our ankles, the only footprints on the beach are the ones we are making, that the sea dissolves as if we had never been. And a kind of companion poem to that, which I wrote more recently, thinking about climate change, is maybe a little bit darker, but the title is World Without Us. No one has told the gulls the human world is doomed. They scrabble loudly over the herring ball, roiling in the sun. But those two crows, crying as they strut the tide line this afternoon, give a piercing, inconsolable moan. The sun doesn't know, nor the tide, or the big combers rolling in to take out the fire ring rocks, flatten the beach, and rearrange the logs. They will keep thrashing the shore long after we are gone, when the sea has moved 100 feet up into the trees and carved out a newer island. Who will miss our loud machines and brutal histories? Will anything miss our beach chairs and the shouts of children playing in the shallows, our tended gardens and tamped roads connecting house to house? The wrens in summer thickets will still be here, and morning's stillness, I hope. What of our words, our small, thin songs of praise or love? Leave them to the whales. I hope the whales go on, carrying this longing through the deep, watery canyons of the world. And for the shore, the crows' dark lament. Thank you.
You don't just get to sit there, you know. You're going to have to do things for me. I'm the teacher. I'm Gabriela Gutierrez Simos. And I will read from this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful anthology I hope you all purchase. It's got incredible, incredible illustrations. I want to thank everybody. I want to thank Phil, who turns out we know each other from Arendelle Books, but I had no idea he'd be here. And I especially want to thank Paul Nelson and Jason Worth, because they are the pillars of Cascadia Poetics Lab. And they built, along with Adelia, who's not here, this incredible book. Fishing. Cast your nets wide in your new paradigm. May it not be fish you catch. Lanza tu red de par en par en tu nuevo paradigma, que no sea pescado lo que pescas. Can you hear me? Or, yeah, okay. Zen. The tree's tree. The river's river, the snow kisses the lake in ice, the Olympics blush one sunset at a time. The umbilical cord has not detached yet from its earth, apples still grow. Grapes and berries arrive to markets, lettuce has fingernails on its cover of chapters and pages. Sometimes workers touch our mouths through produce. Our senses revive in peels. Changing clothes by midday is common in Seattle. Meditating is normalized. We shrink our minds so often to capture them in a possible snowflake. The rain tea from chamomile, elderflowers, roses, and geraniums is the earth's afternoon treat and its accoutrement. Dogs know this is not Kansas. Empower, they bark for treats, touch, toys, capital sins of indulgence, mirroring our need for nothing. In this poem, the third poem included, I only have three, so I'm feeling a little bit like, oh, I only have three. But no, mine are in parts. This is called Seattle Nahuatl, and it's Nahuatl because Aztlan is thought by some Chicanos to be Seattle, the land of lakes, the land of hawks. And so that's in that spirit I wrote that poem, and I wrote another little short poem that I'll read after this one that is not published here, about Seattle being Aztlan. Seattle Nahuatl. Fall. October in Seattle, the leaves of space needles wrestle with the rain through the window shopping eyes of spirits. Visions threaded from above, desde el más allá. Winter. Winter snow shelters traffic lights to shine like Christmas trees on homeless quilts. Spring. The city simmers herbal flower trees. Herbal flower teas on its streets of always water. Summer. Parking garages sizzle like refrying bean oil. Cars, the cheese-like profiles of Scandinavians, happy to park across the street from the sun. And you're going to have to howl for this one. Okay? So, you know the prompt. Mr. Worth, you will have to guide them. This is called Seattle Aznepantla. In this Nepantla, in between land, a country of trees awaits. Read me a plant, read me a cloud, read me the interstice between your colonization and mine. My spirit howls at the coyotes. Ow! Companion, the dog, on one side of our constructed fence. Wood separates us from them. Wood separates them from us. She knows how to talk the forgotten language of spirit. This is a little bit about water. So I would really appreciate it, as I'm reading this poem, if people would say, you all have to say water 2 times during this poem. So I'll leave it up to you. It's called Carrying Water. I slept before daybreak when water was abundant.
Water, water.
You can keep saying water. Then we offered perfume and flowers to the Virgin.
Water. Water.
Not water to ourselves. Then, when the world was for others, not merely for us, we knew we would be wrapped in milk warmth. I woke up to empty plastic bottles, thirsty birds on my window, ailing cats staring at probable caregivers, drunk rats in the tube running from hungry players, mean students and the sort, a tube wrecking of alcohol, the weekend odor of depression, Saturday night's desperation of almost naked beauties looking for sex, attention, love, prophecies, someone who might read their hands tonight, adorn their outfits, provide a compliment perhaps that lasts a week. I cannot stay awake. My soul is knocking.
Water.
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 The Sandman is caressing with its fears.
Water.
Saturday nightmares, cat naps, sleeping pills, canned meats, fish dropped by a bird on my plate. Never solitude.
Water.
Thank you.
I'm Paul Nelson. I'm one of the co-editors of this book. I'm the founding director of the Cascadia Poetics Lab. And every time Gabriela has that line about cheese-like profiles of Scandinavians, I think about her reading that at the Cascadia Poetry Festival, and then Greg Bem, who quickly consulted ChatGPT, whatever it is, the AI, and there was cheese-like profile of a Scandinavian. I have it here. If you want to see it, I can go back to the correspondence. But it was creepy, yeah. But it's a great line, and I think about it. And then Taryn, I don't have Monoku, but I have American Sentences, 17-syllable poems that I write every day. And one of them goes, Seattle Day, wondering if the solar-powered prayer wheel will turn. So, one project, Cascadian Zen, which is why we're here tonight. Thank you, Phil, for having us. What a beautiful place. So great to be downtown, like in the old days when Elliott Bay was down here. Thank you. We have bookmarks for the book. I think there's piles of bookmarks in the front. If you don't find one, I have some. Our Poetry Postcard Fest, Spontaneous Poetics, every summer. You get on a list between the 4th of July and August 31. You have to send out 31 original poems on postcards to the people on your list. Next year will be year 18. We had 518 people in 8 different countries last year. Another bookmark is for Kage on Knee, a writer's retreat center we'd like to put in the Olympics, not the park, but close to it. We're looking at a place in Brennan. It would honor the memory of Sam Hamill, whose house in Port Townsend that he built when he was just founding Copper Canyon Press was called Kageon, or Shadow Hermitage. And we're working hard on this, and we've got a lot of good people who are helping make this a reality. We'd like to get people of color into the woods and demystify the wilderness and make it a place that they can go and feel good about going to. And then one last bookmark, Cascadian Prophets, Our book launch will be February 2nd, and we'll be celebrating our 30th anniversary at the Columbia City Gallery. And even though the book is going to be launched on February 2nd, it's already selling here, and I'm very grateful for that. And, you know, if you want to know a little bit about the poetics of the Cascadia Poetics Lab, you could read this book or the earlier book of interviews, American Prophets, people like Gabriela, Mary Norbert Corti, Robert Bringhurst, Barry McKinnon, Colleen McElroy, Brenda Hillman, Daphne Marlett, Diane DePrima, Miriam Nichols talking about Robin Blazer, an interview with Robin Blazer in here, which was the last one that he gave before he died, Charlie Potts, Peter Cully, and Sam Hamill. Speaking of Sam, oh, by the way, I thought Jason was going to show the map, but he didn't do it. So you just got to see how beautiful, first of all, his brother's photography is throughout the book. His brother's got a book of photographs coming out within the next 5 years. And here's the map of Cascadia. So if you haven't seen that, and, you know, if you want to go further, David McCloskey's maps, and you can get them in very big size, but I think they sell them at Metzger Maps. They are so evocative. And you can really see why it is Cascadia, how the San Andreas Fault goes on the southern sort of boundary of Cascadia and then goes out 1,000 miles due west, one of the few straight lines in nature. And it's really an evocative map. And it's his life's work to map this and to give us a guide to understanding how to be here, which Sam Hamill knew about a little bit. Sam Hamill of Cascadia. I came here nearly 40 years ago, broke and half broken, having chosen the mud, the dirt road, alder pollen, and 100 avenues of gray across the sky to be my teachers and my muses. I chose a temple made of words and made a vow. I scratched a life in hard pan. If I cried for mercy or cried out in delight, it was because I was a man choosing carefully his way and his words, growing as slowly as the trunks of cedars in the sunlit garden. Let the ferns and the moss remember all that I have lost or loved, for I carry no regrets, no ambition to live it all again. I can't make it better than it's been or will be again, as the seasons turn and an old man's heart turns nostalgic as he drinks alone. I've lived in Cascadia, no paradise nor any hell, but both at once and made, as Elitis said, of the same material. A poor poet, I studied war and love, but Cascadia is what I'm of. Jan Zwicky, Canadian poet. One of the beautiful things about this book, as Jason was pointing out, we try and ignore the 49th parallel. And I think that when people start reading and getting to know the Canadian poets, they're going to realize how good they are and how our relationship with Canada is an example of that imperialism that needs to be defeated and resisted at every step. And to know the Canadian poets better has been one of the great joys of this work. And having a chance to stay at the house of Jan Zwicky and Robert Bringhurst was a real honor on Quadra Island. So you can imagine up there, if you've ever been to those islands, they're like the San Juans, but further north, beached seal dying. It could be, I shouldn't wait with you when I'm dying. I might want to be alone, without distraction, work to do, unhooking and unbraiding, loosening the seams. I'd be glad if it were like this, though, under open sky, near dusk, the bow wave of a distant ferry, motionless, a gull, tipped sideways for a second in the wind. John Brehm hoped to be here tonight from Portland, couldn't make it. Very, very short poem called, I'm probably going to read this twice like Taryn did, because this is even shorter than haiku. On turning 64, the slowing down is speeding up. On turning 64, the slowing down is speeding up. I can tell you after basketball last night, I feel his pain. Another person greatly responsible for the poetics of this book is Michael McClure. And he has beautiful poems in here. And I have some poems that are based on his Dharma Devotion, Touching the Edge, Dharma Devotions from the Hummingbird Sangha. He did this beautiful book. If you can find it, it's fantastic. I think published by Shambhala, like a sutra book. And I caught on to one of the phrases, flexible mind, and I've written a series of poems called Flexible Mind. This one's for Rob Lewis. Flexible mind is rooted in a place, most any place. The secretary of transpiration knows water begets water, soil is the womb, and vegetation is the midwife before he plants a future cloud in the ground of his bioregion. Flexible as water. Savvy as the crows, ruin lawns with beaks hunting European chafer beetle grubs. Crow sushi, wily mind, flexible as a crow. Do they ruin the lawns in your neighborhood? These crows pecking and trying to get these bugs all over. Flexible mind revels in the awe of a new morning as apprentice clouds birth out of the mouth of a December arson sky. No lie, I am only here to grow a soul, finish the leftover bee pollen, turkey soup, pickled ginger, and sink an ear into the sounds of Abdullah Ibrahim's piano. Mannenberg Revisited, soundtrack for the rising pink, salmon, blue-black morning sky. Dispersing 50 seagulls. It is all this sparkling illusion that makes me feel real and not just a meaty stumble of rotating cravings. This was a postcard poem. During the pandemic year, we stayed home and wrote postcard poems. We extended the Postcard Fest. Usually starts on the 4th of July. We started it at the spring equinox. And a couple of years ago, I started making most of my own cards. And so I wrote this 2 days after Michael died. He died on May 4th, 2020. That's what the postcard looked like. It's in the book like that. Has an epigraph by Michael describing a person doing Latihan Kejuan is what he's doing. So the spiritual practice of the Subud spiritual community that I've been associated with for 19 years that I met Adelia through. It's the best description in print of someone doing Latihan I've ever read, because you're not supposed to look at other people. Michael was somehow either had a photographic memory of it or took some notes, and it's amazing. And so this is the quote. If his eyes were not already closed, the pleasure would shut them. He has allowed his consciousness to become a blank field. And so goes the rebel lion, rebellion, on surrender to the great life force. And so goes his one last act of mammal patriotism. Splash of Johnny Walker black on his lips. This is reason, but so is grrrr. That would be fun to do, Gabriella. Grrrr. Can we do grrrr? It's fun to do grrrr. He called that his beast language. And he wrote these poems called Ghost Tantras. And they're beautiful. They're amazing poems. In fact, we don't have any ghost tantras in the book. We have some McClure work. And so I'll end with this. Michael, like Gary, very much inspired by Dogen, who was the founder of Soto Zen, and an amazing poet who not only were reading 800 years later, but started a spiritual community that is still thriving to this day. I think that's pretty amazing. It's a spiritual community for me, I'll tell you that. So this is from McClure's Dogen Sonata 2, and I guess this will end our evening. It's been so beautiful to hear everybody's work in their own voices. You know, you see the poems, you put the ones you like in the book, and you go through this whole three-year process, what we were doing during the pandemic, putting together this book, and then you hear the poet read it in their own voice, and it's just so beautiful. And then to see who they're picking out to honor, like Judith and Robert Sund and everyone else, it just, each time, it comes alive in its own way, and it's so beautiful to see that. And Michael was such a gigantic influence on me, so if you want to know about our poetics, read his introduction to three poems, and you'll get a real good sense from that. From Dogen Sonata 2, The five white plum petals open where plum blossoms open. Each petal lies back and presses pollen forward. The painter Seshu and the poet Keats dance in the cold, stiff earth among roots and branches, covered with suns and white blossoms. Each bough of flowers is an eye reflecting nothing in this dewdrop, reflecting nothing that hangs on the tip of a dark-skinned twig, dropping. Right now is the twig. It is dew and blossoms as the drop falls. Everyone says this. They are petals of one white flower, remembering that in snow worlds, there is snow before blossoms. Snow and dew are time on the branch, as the drop made of changing pictures that the moon shines through is falling. Sound makes a pool, because there is no old age in death. Death's petals are an eye, and age is shatterproof glass brushed by a windy branch. Tiny diamonds spatter a round nasturtium leaf, and a baby snail rests in the orange flower. Thank you.